best way I can? How about a sign that says, I want to run again? Fiona asks quietly. That's not begging. That's just stating a simple fact. I look around at their expectant faces. I do want to run again. I do want to help. I take a deep breath. Okay, somebody make me a sign. Chapter 20. Having me out on the sidewalk works. It also almost causes a couple of fender benders. I guess carrying a sign gives people license to stare, double take, and rubberneck. There are no actual accidents, though, just a steady stream of customers. A lot of them aren't so much interested in getting their car washed as they are in writing a check. I see them talking to Cairo. I see them glancing at me. I see them shaking their heads and pulling out their wallets. Some of them even come up to me and tell me stories about their uncle or their dad or their army buddy who served in Iraq. They treat me like they've known me my whole life. I guess they're trying to make me feel better or not alone. But it's kind of bizarre to have people I don't even know telling me these personal stories, especially the gruesome ones about Iraq. I'm not up for hearing all those details, but what am I supposed to do? I just smile and nod and take it. Then Gavin Vance arrives. I'm suddenly and completely re-embarrassed. I want to pull on my sweats. Hide. I try to get back to simply holding my sign, but I can't help sneaking looks at him. He hugs Merrill, who is ecstatic to see him. They laugh, hold hands. She feeds him a brownie. I force myself to stop looking, but I can't seem to quit wondering if any guy, Gavin or otherwise, will ever look at me. Will ever want me? It's not the first time I've thought this, but seeing Gavin and Merrill together makes the thought feel so raw. I glance over my shoulder again and see that Gavin's now talking to Cairo. A minute later, he's still talking to Cairo. Fiona's been observing all this, too, and when Gavin starts to leave, she mutters, "He couldn't even come over and say hi." But Gavin doesn't go back to his car. He dashes across the street while traffic is held back by the red light. "What is he doing?" Fiona asks. "Running," I say, with a twinge of sarcasm. When he gets to the center divider, he turns and faces us, then produces a camera and motions for us to hold our signs higher. "Oh," Fiona says, "newspaper." I'm really upset now. I don't want to be seen like this in the school newspaper. "It'll get donations," Fiona says, and nudges my arm up. "Just hold up your sign." Before I can even think to yell, "Hey, you need my permission to do that," Gavin has already taken some shots and is running back across the street. And in a flash, he's inside his car and driving away. I don't say anything, but I'm kind of mad at Fiona. And I'm really mad at Gavin. He should have at least asked. So I decide, Monday morning, I'm going to find him and put a stop to him using those pictures. Chapter 21. The car wash event brings in a whopping $876.50. I'm amazed. Cairo's pleased. The team's excited. And Dad is very impressed. $876? He asks on the way home. And 50 cents, I add. Someone baked that extra brownie. You know, it counts. He smiles and nods. Let's not forget the 50 cents. But after I'm home for a little while, I start feeling deflated and sore. I can't walk evenly. My body is tender all over. My stump is throbbing. I need to take my leg off and rest. By bedtime, I realize that I way overdid it. I fall asleep easily, but I don't sleep well. It hurts to roll over. I'm too hot. Then I'm too cold. And then I have the running dream again. Only this time, I'm not really running. I'm clumping. Sherlock is barking at me to hurry up. He runs ahead, turns, barks. Runs ahead, turns, barks. I know what he's saying. Come on, let's go. Let's go. But I can't. No matter how hard I try, all I can do is clump along. Clump, clump, clump. I look down and see my leg. It's just a big steel pipe. No foot, no shoe. Clump, clump, clump. Bark, bark, bark. Clump, clump, clump. Bark, bark, bark. Clump, clump. I wake up with a jolt to find my mother on the edge of my bed. She's holding the phone and the Sunday paper, which is still in its dew-proof bag. "Sorry to wake you," she whispers. "That's okay," I murmur, glad to be out of the dream. She hands over the phone. "It's Fiona. She says it's important and that I should give you this." She puts the newspaper next to me. "Hello?" I say into the phone. "Have you opened the paper?" she asks. "No," I mumble. "I'm still asleep." I eye the clock. It's not even 7. "Well, wake up! You're on the front page of the community section." "I am?" I ask, still groggy. "How?" "Gavin wrote an article. It's amazing." Now I'm awake. "Gavin did?" "Yes, and there's a huge picture of you. Open the paper." Mom's giving me a questioning look, so I tell her, "Can you open the paper, go to the community section?" "Section C," Fiona says in my ear. But Mom finds the section without any extra help. She pulls it out, unfolds it, and we both gasp. There's an enormous picture of me, just me, holding up my sign. "I want to run again." So much for my stopping him from using the picture. But strangely, I'm not mad. I'm more in shock. Fiona can tell we've found the article. "Call me back when you've read it," she says with a laugh, then hangs up. The headline is, "Getting Back on Track." The byline is, "Gavin R. Vance." Mom's hands are shaking, so I snatch the paper from her and hold it steady so we both can read. "Jessica Carlisle was a world-class runner, or, according to her track coach Leonard Kyrokowski, well on her way to becoming one. She set a new league record in the 400-meter race just hours before the accident. She had the discipline, the determination. She had incredible potential." The accident to which Kyrokowski refers involved a school bus transporting the Liberty High School track teams and an uninsured junkyard hauler named Jack Lowe. "Even if I didn't know you," my mom whispers, "I'd read this article. It pulls you right in." "Shh," I tell her. And together, we continue to read all about the accident and the track team's quest to buy me a running leg. There's a nice, smaller picture of the track team working the car wash and a sidebar that has the heading, "Help Jessica Run Again," and gives the school's contact information for anyone who wants to donate money. The whole page is put together very well. But it's the closing part of the article that really gets me. "Jessica Carlisle may have lost a leg, but she has not lost her spirit. Last Thursday, she was back at the track, cheering from the sidelines as her teammates battled Langston High in a dual league meet. Next year, she'd like to be back on the track, running." "This is a wonderful piece," my mother sniffs, brushing away a tear. She points to the byline. "Do you know the writer?" I hesitate. Do I know him? He gives amazing speeches, writes fantastic op-eds and now newspaper features, spearheads community warmth drives, and he dates a manipulative ditz. My mother prompts, "You said Gavin did to Fiona?" I concede with a little nod. "He's in our class, but I don't really know him." "Well," she says, easing the paper away from me, "I'm sure Cairo has his number. You should call him. This definitely deserves a thank you." She leaves, no doubt to show Dad the article. And I know I should be calling Fiona back, but I just sit there for the longest time trying to sort through the collision of feelings I have about Gavin Vance. Chapter 22. I do try to reach Gavin, but the message machine seems to be the only one home. I hang up the first couple of times, but on my third try, I leave a message. It's a pretty lame one. Incoherent, really. And right before I hang up, I rattle off my phone number, then immediately wish I hadn't. What's he supposed to call back for? To tell me to learn to leave a message? I don't even want him to call back. I already said thank you. What's left to say? Still, every time the phone rings, I jump a little. Every time it turns out to be someone else on the line, I scold myself. But Monday morning when he sees me from across the courtyard and leaves Merrill's side to come talk to me, I feel my cheeks flush. I try to be cool and blithely witty as we talk, but me making him laugh makes me laugh. And when he finally goes back to Merrill, I realize that my eyes are shining and my cheeks ache from smiling so much. Suddenly, I feel like crying. What an idiot I am. I escape the courtyard, and for the rest of the week, I avoid him. I stay away from the main hangouts. I hide out in Cairo's classroom or drag Fiona into room 402 at lunch, and I focus on important things like schoolwork and walking. Especially walking. I work really hard on my gait, on my roll-off, on mastering ramps. By Thursday, I'm confident enough to leave my cane at home, which feels like a huge step forward. And random people who I don't even know tell me how awesome it is to see me walking. But then comes a huge step back. At lunch, Cairo breaks it to Fiona and me that Gavin's newspaper article has brought in only $40.
I don't understand it,
he says, raking his long fingers along his hair.
I was sure there would be an outpouring of goodwill.
Maybe it's still coming, Fiona says. He sighs.
Let's hope. Unfortunately, there's often a deep, wide abyss between good intentions and concrete action. And as unfair as it is, after a few days, any story becomes old news.
He looks at me.
It's disappointing, but don't worry. We'll raise the money.
Still, I can't help but be discouraged. And Rosa picks up on my mood in math.
What's wrong?
She writes in a note.
The running leg's a pipe dream.
She slips the note back.
So was walking.
Ms. Rucker is watching me, so I hide the note and focus on the board. Until Rosa slides another note my way.
Don't look so far ahead.
I slip the note into my backpack and find my mood spiraling even further downward. Looking ahead is what's been giving me hope. I've wanted to believe that somehow we'll be able to gather $20,000. I've wanted to believe that I'll run again. But hope now feels so fragile. Too fragile to touch. Chapter 23. After school, I see the track teams loading onto a bus. I stand in the distance and watch, feeling cold and shaky.
How can they even get on a bus?
I remind myself that it's not their first away meet since the wreck. There have been two of them, plus the Glenwood relays. For them, the memory must be fading. For me, it feels like yesterday. And every tomorrow, for as far as I can see. Chapter 24. Friday, when I visit Hank, he's very impressed.
Fantastic, he says over and over. Now that's progress.
My mom and I exchange glances, and I can tell she's thinking what I'm thinking. Hank seems so different. It's like he's come to life because the monster he's built has come to life. He makes lots of little adjustments with his Allen wrench, twisting it inside the little holes in the pipe couplings as he throws around words like adduction and abduction, dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, inversion and eversion. He makes me walk, he adjusts, he makes me walk, he adjusts, and when he's finally done, he smiles at me.
I saw the article in the paper, Great piece. And if your progress this week is any indication, I have no doubt that you will be running again. Soon.
Thanks, I tell him. And it's nice to see him so enthused. The problem, though, is that his enthusiasm doesn't stick on me. It's been a long, hard week. And all I can seem to see is that I'm still having trouble walking. Part 4. Adjusting the blocks. Chapter 1. It's still dark outside. The streetlights glow through the curtains, putting a soft spotlight on Sherlock, who is fast asleep on my bed. He's curled up next to Lucas the Bear near the footboard, his back resting against the wall, his chin on the bedspread facing me. Even in his sleep, he's watching me, protecting me. I admire his beautiful coat, the dark lines of his eyes, his pointy ears and droopy whiskers. I want to kiss his muzzle and tell him what a sweet, sweet boy he is. And then I get the feeling, the one I've kept buried for so long. I have to get up, get out, go. Maybe I can do it, I tell myself. Not fast, not hard, but maybe I can run. Sherlock! It's barely even a whisper, but his eyes fly open. You want to go for a... I stop myself. Outside? He cocks his head, not entirely sure whether what he thinks I'm asking is what I'm really asking. For that matter, neither am I. Get your frisbee, I tell him. He jumps off the bed and darts down the stairs, but he knows it'll be a little while before I can get down there. I slip on the nylon, then pull on a stump sock. I layer on another sock. My leg's still shrinking, so I need the extra padding to keep my socket snug. Then I put on the liner, push into my pipe leg, and roll up the suction sleeve. It feels solid, but still foreign. Like we're still getting to know each other. I sit on the edge of the bed and dress, pulling on my zip sweats, lacing on my left shoe, zipping up a sweatshirt. I'm better at the stairs now, but still very careful. Up is easier than down. Sherlock waits patiently at the bottom, tail wagging, frisbee at his feet. Good boy, I whisper, then leave a quick note and ease out the front door. The air is cool and moist from a light fog, perfect running weather. I breathe in deeply and close my eyes. Something in my mind doesn't know I can't run. Something inside me believes I can just take off. Sherlock puts down the frisbee and looks up at me. He's holding his breath, hoping. I pick up the frisbee and say, "Heel!" He falls into place on my left side as we go down our walkway, but he's keyed up, waiting for something big to happen. When I get to the sidewalk, I turn left instead of our usual right. I sense his confusion, his disappointment. "Fetch!" I tell him and toss the frisbee a straight, controlled distance down the sidewalk. He tears off after it, and while he's gone, I take a few jogging steps. It's enough to tell me that I cannot run. Sherlock is already back. I toss the frisbee again. I try jogging again. I make it 10 steps this time, 20 the next, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like running. It doesn't feel like anything but hard, hard work. I think of Kaylee counting steps. I try again, try not to count. I feel like a lifeless machine moving forward. I rest at the corner, more disappointed than tired. Sherlock, however, is enjoying the frisbee game immensely, and so we turn the corner and press on. I try jogging a few more times, but eventually I just give up and walk. I tell myself I should be happy with walking. Walking is a miracle. I press on, and then through the misty air, I hear my name. It's soft, drifting toward me from the left.
Jessica!
I turn, and it's like I'm thrown into a dream. There's a mermaid fountain in the middle of the yard, and beyond it, a girl sitting on the porch wrapped in a white blanket.
Rosa?
I ask.
Jessica!
She says again. It takes me a moment to understand that I'm not dreaming. When I do, I clap twice, bringing Sherlock running back to me, and we both head up the walkway. There's a ramp up the side of the porch steps, just like there still is on ours. I can't believe you're up so early, I say with a laugh.
Look who's talking, she says back.
But why are you out here?
I love mornings, she says. They are so peaceful.
She's got her eye on Sherlock.
He's gorgeous.
Sherlock, this is Rosa, I say, making the official introduction. Say hi.
Aroo!
Sherlock says, wagging his tail. Rosa reaches out tentatively to pet him. He's very friendly, I say, sitting on a bench that's near her wheelchair. Don't worry. Soon, she's hugging Sherlock around his neck, giggling from being slobbered with doggy kisses.
You were taking him for a walk?
She asks, when Sherlock settled down a little. I shrug. I actually wanted to see if I could run. I eye her and add, which I can't.
You will, though,
she says with her lopsided smile.
I put that article on my bedroom wall.
You did? She nods.
It's so cool.
Then she says,
tell me about running. Why do you like it?
No one has ever asked me this so directly before. Either people like running or they don't. Either people get it or they don't. And if they don't, they just think people who like it are crazy, which is okay. That makes us even. But now I have to explain why I like it, and I'm not sure where to start. Running or racing? She thinks and then says,
running. Like this morning.
I try to put my finger on it. Because it feels like freedom? She nods thoughtfully. And your mind travels places where it doesn't normally go?
Huh?
Like dreaming in real time? I laugh. Never mind. It sounds crazy. She laughs, too. So I say the next thing that pops into my mind. I love the morning air on my face. It's one of the best things about running. The rest of your body's warm, but your face is cool. I laugh again. I totally get why dogs like to stick their head out of car windows. Running's like that, but with fewer bugs in your teeth. She laughs again, then sighs and says,
I wish I could feel that.
What? I kid her. Your mom won't let you stick your head out the window while she's driving? What kind of mom do you have?
A good one.
Then she says,
now racing.
Huh? Oh, what do I like about racing? She nods. So I give that some thought, and finally tell her, it's electric. From stepping into your lane until you cross the finish line, every cell of your body is charged.
Going over the finish line must be wonderful.
I laugh, especially if you're the first one there.
But it means you finished. You made it, even if you don't get a medal.
I look at her. You're very philosophical about the finish line. She gives a thoughtful nod.
It's symbolic.
I nod too, because I'm sure I know what she means. But then she adds,
because it's also the starting line.
For some reason, this thought startles me. And I think about all the races where this is true. The 400, the 800, the 1600, all the relays. And it shocks me that I have never looked at it this way. Maybe because of staggered starts. Maybe because starting feels so different from finishing. At the starting line, you're amped, set, coiled. At the finish line, you're completely spent. So the thought that they're the same line gives me a very strange feeling, a sort of uncomfortable feeling, like discovering someone very close to you has been leading a secret double life. Chapter 2. Monday during math, Rosa slips me a note.
Running or racing, which would you choose?
She slips me questions like this a lot, or statements, or combinations.
Baby steps are blessings. Wind is mysterious. Where does it go?
Sometimes they seem so off the wall, but they always make me think. This time I consider the question, but I also think about Rosa thinking about running. Why does she spend her time pondering something she'll never be able to do? Why is she interested in it at all? Why in the world would she philosophize about the finish line? I jot back. Running. I know immediately that it's what I'd choose. Still, it's the first time I've actually thought about it. Chapter 3. By Tuesday, we've given up on getting more donations from Gavin's newspaper article. It's been over a week, and they just haven't arrived. Wednesday morning, the bake sale table is missing from the courtyard. And at lunch, there's only one person staffing it, plus all the baked goods are store-bought, so no one's buying. Then, Thursday morning, there's a message in the announcements. All track team members are to report to Coach Cairo's classroom at lunch. Be prompt, no exceptions.
Sounds ominous,
Fiona mutters. Maybe it's just about today's meet? She shakes her head. We went over that at practice yesterday. By lunch, I've convinced myself that the meeting is to scold the team for giving up on raising money for my leg, and I walk into Cairo's room feeling dread. Why should my team be expected to raise $20,000? It's crazy. What's worse is I don't want them to resent me, or feel like failures because they couldn't do the impossible. Within the first 5 minutes of lunch, over 90 people have crammed into Cairo's room. Even Merrill.
Guys,
Cairo finally says, holding one graceful hand high.
I'll make this quick.
Everyone falls silent.
Item one, he says. I've noticed a lackluster attitude growing among you.
I close my eyes and think, oh boy, here we go. He levels a look across the room.
That didn't take long. We've been fundraising for 2 weeks and already you give up?
No one moves a muscle, but I can feel it. Everyone's shrinking away from me.
Where's your spirit? He asks. Where's your determination, your drive? You hit a little headwind and let it knock you flat? Hasn't being on this team taught you that around the bend of every headwind comes a tailwind?
We just look at him.
Item two. He says. The office delivered this to me today.
He holds up a stack of envelopes.
For some reason, the helpers in the front office didn't know who to give Jessica mail to, so they collected it in a box.
He smiles at us.
So, here's our tailwind. The checks range from $5 to $250, and our new grand total is $4,765.
A roar fills the room.
Item three, he shouts,
and we all fall quiet.
We have a patron, someone who insists on staying anonymous. They have pledged a dollar for every dollar we raise, up to $10,000. Wait, Mario Reed says, so that means we're already up to like 9,500? Very good. Cairo says.
He looks around the room.
We are almost halfway there, people.
Cheers fill the room again. And this time people pump fists and pat me on the back and give me double thumbs up. Kyra lets it go on for a minute before raising his hand again.
Last item.
There's more? People whisper to each other.
We will have visitors at our meet this afternoon. Channel 7 is sending a local news crew out to do a story on the team and on Jessica.
Wait, Mario says again. We're going to be on TV?
Cairo nods.
They saw the article in the paper and want to help get the word out.
He looks at me.
You will be there today, right?
I'm smiling and laughing and crying all at the same time.
You bet,
I tell him as I wipe my face dry.
How do you feel about wearing a uniform?
I hesitate. It was one thing to wear it at a car wash when I didn't know I was going to be in the paper. It's another to wear it knowing I'll be on TV. Mario starts a chant.
Do it, do it, do it.
It doesn't take long for everyone to chime in.
Do it, do it, do it.
I pinch my eyes closed. How can I not?
Okay,
I blurt out.
I'll do it.
Yay, the team cheers. Remember, people, Cairo calls out. This is the last league meet. Let's win this thing.
From the roar that follows, there is no doubt that that's exactly what they plan to do. Chapter 4. The team is loving having a news crew around. They make a show of everything, especially crossing the finish line. So far, the crew is not talking to me, so I try to forget that they're even there and not feel too self-conscious about my very visible fake leg. I do my best to act normal, and I shadow Fiona as she moves from event to event. The only time I really forget about my leg is when Chandel comes in second in the 100-meter dash. I cheer my head off for that because she usually gets edged back to fourth, and the best she's placed all year is third.
Way to go, Chandel! I yell as she prances into the infield.
She works her way over to me.
That felt so good, she pants. Girl, I was flying. Yes, you were.
I bump her fist when she puts it up.
Flying with flames shooting from your feet.
Chandel laughs. Glad you could see him, because I could sure feel him.
She cocks her head at something behind me and lowers her voice.
You've got company.
I turn around and see the TV news crew standing behind me. Jessica? The news lady asks. Her blonde hair is tied down with a scarf. She's wearing a designer sweatsuit and cute little pumas, nothing like what she wears when she's anchoring the news.
I'm Marla Sumner. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I shake her hand. She's smaller than she looks on TV, and even prettier.
This is my photographer, Andy Richards, she says, indicating the man lugging a large black camera bag, a tripod, and a big lens video camera.
He flashes a smile, then gets busy with his equipment.
Your coach says you're okay with being interviewed?
I nod.
Good.
She looks around, then points to a spot farther infield.
Why don't we do it over there?
I'd like to get the finish line in the background. It doesn't take long for them to set up. Marla tells me to look at her, not at the camera, and the first thing she has me do is state my name. After that, she's off and running with questions. I'm nervous at first, but since the camera's a little off to the side, I try to block it out and just answer her questions. She's very attentive and nods a lot, and before too long, she's done.
Thank you so much, Jessica, she says. This is an important story, and we want to do what we can to help.
I appreciate that, I say softly.
How do you feel about us coming to your home? I think it would add a personal dimension if we could include your family in the story.
I think that would be okay. You should ask my mom and dad, though.
So I give her our phone number, thank her again, and set out to find Fiona because her heat of the 800 meter has just been called. I run into Gavin Vance instead.
Hey, he says. I heard the good news.
I look down because holding his gaze is just unnerving.
Nice little snowball you got rolling.
I glance up. Thanks.
Hey, if it wasn't a worthy story, they wouldn't be here.
Thanks, I tell him again, then start moving across the infield.
It's Fiona's race, right?
He asks, following me.
You heading up to Rigor Mortis Bend?
I cock my head a little.
Wow, you better watch out. People might start thinking you're part of the team.
This seems to please him, and he falls into step beside me as I trek up to the 300-meter mark.
I'm starting to feel a little like it, actually.
I snort.
Yeah? Well, you've got a lot of wind sprints to catch up on, buddy.
He laughs, then says,
But I did take your advice.
About?
Running for more than just an office.
I keep moving. So, you what, went for a run? He nods.
I've been a few times, actually.
He laughs again.
The first one was torture. It's been a long time.
We walk in silence for a few steps. And then he says,
You're amazing.
This catches me off guard, until I realize he's talking about the fact that I'm walking on a pipe.
Cairo asked me to wear the uniform, I say with a frown. I'm not trying to be an exhibitionist or anything. Are you kidding me? Who thinks that?
He shakes his head.
Do you realize how fast you're walking?
The gun's gone off for Fiona's race, so I pick up the pace even more.
There's no stopping you, is there?
He says with a chuckle.
Not where Fiona's concerned, I tell him.
She has been the most incredible friend. I don't know if it's my comment about Fiona or him not wanting to leave me alone on Rigor Mortis Bend, but he stays there with me. I cheer for Fiona on her first lap, and when she hits the 600-meter mark on her second time around, she's trailing the first-place runner from Hartwell, but not by much. When she crests the curve and hits the bend, I can see the grit on Fiona's face, the focus. I shout, You can do it! Fiona, pass her! Gavin cheers her on, too, and it's cute because you can tell he's never actually done this before. Words come out, but they're shy. He's shouting, but there's nothing really loud about it. When Fiona hits the straightaway, her head bobs and she bears down, moving out a lane to pass the girl from Hartwell. Kick it, Fiona, kick it in, I shout, and then hold my breath as she edges ahead and wins the race. She did it, I squeal, and I find myself jumping and hugging just like I would with anyone else on the team. Only this isn't just anyone. This is Gavin Vance. And it's my first physical contact with him of any kind. I've never even accidentally bumped or brushed or touched him before, and now I'm hugging him? Sorry, I say, pulling away. Then I try to cover up my embarrassment with words. It's just, oh, you have no idea how hard the 800 is. There's no way you could get me to run that race. It's the 400 times two. Rigor mortis bend twice. I have trouble facing it even once. I start moving away from him.
Well, I'm going to go congratulate her. Thanks for helping cheer her on. And I escape.
Not that there's any danger of him following me. Not with Meryl making a beeline toward him the way she is. Chapter 5. Both varsity teams win handily against Hartwell, and the JV boys and girls squeak by. But it's still a sweep, and everyone is pumped. Meryl's nowhere to be found, but what else is new? And since Gavin disappeared with her, it's easy for me to just celebrate the moment with my team. Afterward, Fiona drops me at home, and to my surprise, the Channel 7 news van is parked at the curb. When I get inside the house, I hear my dad saying,
They're still arguing about whose responsibility it is, and meanwhile, what are we supposed to do? This was a school event. It happened on a school bus.
I can't believe he's telling them this. And the cameraman is getting it all on video.
Dad, I say, throwing down my backpack, what are you trying to do, get everyone at school to hate me?
Marla Summers signals the cameraman to cut, then turns to me.
This is a really important part of the story, Jessica.
No! The story is that my team is trying to do something amazing and positive. We do not have to get into all this negative stuff. She considers this a moment, then has some silent exchange with my dad before smiling at me and saying, "Your mother told me about Sherlock. Could we get some footage of you and him in your front yard?" "Sure," I tell her. Anything to change the subject. Anything to get her away from my dad. After about 10 minutes outside, Marla and her cameraman pack up and take off. I hang outside with Sherlock a little longer because I'm still upset with my father. But when I go back inside, I discover that he's upset with me. He sits me down at the kitchen table. Mom is standing off to the side, quiet.
"I'm sorry if you think I'm being negative," he says. "I'm sorry if you didn't want me to talk about the school district's obligation to meet your basic medical needs, but here's the reality. While the insurance companies are dragging their feet, I am working 12, 14, 16 hours a day to keep us afloat. While they're deciding who is responsible for your hospital bills, your mother and I have taken out a second mortgage on this house. It won't begin to pay for everything, but for now it'll put off collection agencies and ruined credit or bankruptcy. Because their lawyers are playing a game of cat and mouse, we've had to hire our own, and he's told us that these kind of cases usually take years to settle. But if we don't fight for your rights now, you will get a measly settlement that won't include the medical care and prosthetic limbs that you'll need in the years ahead. You're still growing, Jessica, and your body will keep changing. Plus, prosthetic legs wear out. I've researched this, and you will need dozens of legs in your lifetime. At $20,000 a pop, that's not something we're willing to let go or pretend isn't a problem. As your parents, we need to prepare for your future. Anything less would be completely irresponsible. So if you think I was being negative with the news crew, I'm sorry. The fact is, I'm just looking out for you."
"How was I supposed to know?" I snap. "Why didn't you tell me any of this before?"
"Maybe we should have," Dad says wearily. "But we thought you were dealing with enough already."
I just sit there feeling awful. I've known that my parents have worries, but I thought they would go away. I figured that in time everything would work itself out. But while I've been living day to day worrying about walking, my parents have been taking the long view, thinking about my future. Before the accident, my future just meant college. College is something I haven't thought about since the accident, but Fiona and I did have plans, big plans. And now, thinking about my future, I'm slapped with the reality that attending our dream college is no longer an option for me. My parents couldn't afford it then. I'll never get a running scholarship now. So Fiona will be going there without me. That thought, along with everything my dad said and the obvious toll this has taken on my parents, hits me in the gut like an unexpected punch. "I'm sorry," I choke out. Then I go up to my room and cry my eyes out. Chapter 6. I seem to have long heart-to-hearts with everyone that night. Mom, Dad, Fiona, Kaylee, even Sherlock. Although the one with him is pretty one-sided. By bedtime, I am sick to death of trying to sort through everything, and I tell Dad that he can call the news station back if he wants to. He kisses me on the forehead and tells me for the 100th time that he wishes he could change things. And then, right before he closes the door, he turns to me and asks,
"What was Lucy's last name?"
"Lucy? Sanders?" I answer. But as he's leaving, I have a horrible thought. "Wait!" He looks back into the room. "You can't have her parents depositioned or dispositioned or whatever you were talking about before. Lucy's dead. They're not going to want to talk to lawyers. It would be mean to ask them to help us." He gives me a curious look, and I can see him trying to stay calm.
"Jessica," he says quietly, "I want to see if I can help them."
Then he closes the door. Chapter 7. League prelims take place over the weekend. Cairo invites me along, but I am still not ready to get on a school bus, let alone stay on one for over 100 miles each way. Instead, I help Mom in her flower garden. She's bought pansies and vinca and gazania, verbena, impatiens and marigolds, and sacks of potting soil. She bustles about uprooting dead plants and weeds and mulching new life into the tired dirt. She's late with her planting this year, and she shouldn't have waited. As the day wears on and the new plants get nestled into earth, her whole being seems to change. She hums. She blooms. Sherlock is out in the yard with us, gnawing on a stick. He seems content, too, ignoring the fluttering birds and the occasional pedestrian. I think about the seasons, about the joys of spring, about the cold, hard days and long, dark nights of winter. I wonder if old people ever look back on their lives and see it in terms of seasons. Years of summer, decades of spring. I wonder what I'll see when I look back later in life. Looking back now, I see 16 years of springtime followed by a deep, sudden freeze. I wonder how long this winter will be for me. I wonder how long I'll have only glimpses of sunshine. I wonder if it'll ever be enough to thaw the freeze, or if the ice will just soften for a moment, then harden again. My mother shakes me from my thoughts. It's so nice to have you out here with me. She takes off her gloves and holds my face. My family and my flowers, that's all I need in this world. I smile and try to hold on to the warmth of her sunshine. Chapter 8. Fiona qualifies easily for the league finals in the 800 and the high jump. I had no doubt that she would, but I heap on the praise anyway. Congratulations, I gush on our way to school Monday morning. I want to hear all about it. She's happy to oblige, but catches herself after a few minutes. Is this okay to do? Of course it is, I say. But the truth is, I'm feeling like I really missed out. She glances at me. I'm sorry, I'm being an idiot. Hey, it's fine. I really want to know. I try to jumpstart her by asking, so did Vanessa dominate the 400? Fiona scowls. Yes, and the hurdles. You should have seen her strutting around. Yeah, well, what else is new? She eyes me. She didn't break your record, though, so nanny on her. I laugh. Nanny on her? Yeah, she says, grinning. Nanny, nanny, no on her. Then she adds, oh, and Meryl didn't even bother to show up. Cairo called her at home when the bus was set to leave and her mother said she was sick. Yeah, right. But she wouldn't have qualified for finals anyway. So how can she say she's part of the team when she's always skipping out or not showing up? It's like cheating. During the day, though, I bump into Gavin 3 times and Meryl is nowhere to be seen. So I start wondering if maybe I've been too hard on her. Maybe she really is sick. Then at lunch, Fiona and I are headed toward the courtyard when we run into Gavin again. Hey there, he says, looking maddeningly handsome. Hey, I say back. How's Meryl feeling? I heard she was sick. Yeah, he says. It really knocked her out. He falls into step beside us. You guys eating lunch in the courtyard? No. I tell him. Actually, I look at Fiona. I want to see how Rosa's doing. I pull a goofy face. For some reason, Ms. Rucker thinks us passing notes in math is a bad thing, and I really need to catch up with her. Which is true. I haven't had much of a chance to talk with Rosa since that morning on her porch. Fiona gives me wiggly-faced signals, but I ignore them. You can go ahead, I tell her. I'll catch up with you later. Then I turn down the walkway to room 402. But Fiona follows. And so does Gavin. Go on, I tell them. You don't have to come with me. Who's Rosa? Gavin asks. She's a freshman, I tell him.
She's got cerebral palsy.
Fiona whispers. She's my friend and a math genius, I tell them both and give Fiona a scolding look. She's been great to me through this whole thing. I stop and shoo them with my hands. Go! I'll catch up with you later. But they don't go. They follow me. The Room 402 gang is surprised to see all of us. Wow, Miss Wall says, lots of company. Billy and Trent seem a little uncomfortable with the invasion. They turn back to their lunches and avoid looking at us. But Alicia and Penny don't mind. They especially seem to like that Gavin's there. Fiona and Gavin hang out while Rosa and I joke around. The rest of us have lunches from home, but Gavin doesn't, so I ask him, don't you want to go get something to eat? No, he says, I'm good. So I slip him half of my sandwich, and half of my sun chips, and half of my apple slices. When lunch is almost over, we say our goodbyes to the Room 402 gang, and on the way down the ramp, Gavin whispers,
can you really understand her? I could only catch a little of what she said.
I nod.
It was hard at first, but now I'm pretty good at it. It's like a dialect. It takes some getting used to, but you eventually figure it out.
At the bottom of the ramp, he turns right toward the courtyard, and we turn left toward the 900 wing.
Get you later,
he calls. And he seems to be smiling at me. Chapter 9. Tuesday morning in first period, Miss Alloy reads the announcements like she does every morning. Most of us doze through it like we do every morning. Until she reads, attention juniors and seniors, the prom is right around the corner. This year's theme is Hollywood Nights, and formal wear is required. Tickets will go on sale Friday in the activities office. $55 per person or $100 per couple. This event is open to juniors and seniors only. Fiona and I look at each other and I roll my eyes. Like anyone's going to ask me to the prom? Like I could dance? Besides, a prom dress and a pipe leg would feel ridiculous together. Immediately after the prom announcement, Miss Alloy reads, all students, be sure to watch Channel 7 News tonight, a very special program featuring our fantastic track team and their Help Jessica Run campaign will be broadcast. Tell your friends, tell your family, and tune in at 5, 6, or 11. Miss Alloy smiles at me. I'll be sure to do that. A little chill runs through me as I realize that Cairo's almost certainly the one behind the announcement, and that he's probably also emailed it to every contact he has in the county. He has no idea the news crew talked to my dad. Fiona tells me not to worry, but I can't seem to concentrate on anything else all day. During math, Rosa slips me a note that says, I'll be watching the news. And for some reason, it makes me write back a long, scribbled note about being worried and why I'm worried, and how I don't even want it to air. She writes back, the truth is always okay. I'm studying her message, thinking about what she's written, when I hear, I look up and see Ms. Rucker standing beside me with her hand out. I'm sorry, I say lamely. I start to put the note away, but she stays there with her hand out, so I plead, it's personal. Her hand stays out. Finally, I turn it over to her and watch as she strolls to the front of the class, her long nose buried in my note. Chapter 10. At 5 o'clock, Mom's setting the recorder so Dad can watch the broadcast when he gets home. Kaylee is sitting cross-legged on the couch, texting her friends, and I'm sweating bullets. Relax, Mom says soothingly as she takes her seat next to me. It's going to be all right. You sound like Rosa, I mutter. Who's Rosa? The Channel 7 News Live at 5 graphics and music come on. I'll tell you later, I whisper, and my heart starts hammering madly in my chest. The camera zooms in on Marla Sumner and her co-anchor Keith Franks.
Good evening, Keith says. Tonight at 5, what would you do if your teammate was tragically injured on the way home from a meet?
Footage of our track meet with Hartwell appears on the screen.
We'll show you what a Liberty High School team is doing to help their fellow runner get back on the track.
That
it's you!
Kaylee squeals. It's gone in a flash, but it's hard to mistake me for anyone else when I'm wearing shorts. But first, Marla says, and then dives into another story. And another, and then there are commercials, and another story, and another, and the weather, and more commercials. And before every commercial break, they run a little teaser segment about the track team and me.
They're not going to show it until the very end,
Kaylee grumbles, texting the whole time. Then, all of a sudden, Marla Sumner is looking right into the camera, saying, "Finally at 5, the story of the Liberty High School track team and the extraordinary efforts they're making to help one of their teammates run again. You may recall our coverage of the tragic bus accident that took the life of one young runner, Lucy Sanders. That accident also took the limb of 16-year-old Jessica Carlisle." The TV switches from Marla in the newsroom to me walking across the infield. It's shot from behind, and it's strange to see myself from that angle. What I notice most is that my gait is still uneven. "Hours before the accident, Jessica set a league record in the 400-meter race," Marla's voice says over the footage. Then the picture switches to Cairo on the field talking into the news microphone. "She's incredibly talented," he says. "A tremendously gifted runner. Now that she's back on her feet, we want to get her back on the track."
"A seemingly impossible dream," Marla's voice says.
"Only if you haven't seen the latest advancements in running prostheses." Over a graphic of a running leg, she goes on to describe how single and double leg amputees are able to compete on sleek carbon graphite running blades that absorb impact and store energy much like an Achilles tendon.
"Wow," Mom whispers. "She's done her research."
"But with this dream," Marla's voice continues, "comes a price tag. With fittings, fabrication, and ongoing adjustments, a leg like this costs around $20,000. But that's where all 4 divisions of the Liberty High School track team come in." Suddenly, my friends are on the screen, waving, angling for FaceTime, hamming it up.
"She just wants to run again," they shout in unison.
Then Marla's voiceover is back. "But how can a track team raise $20,000? There's a tight shot now of Mario Reed and his friends.
"We're doing bake sales and car washes," they shout.
Mario looks right into the camera.
"But we sure could use some help."
The shot switches to Annie and Giselda, who are introduced as dynamo hurdlers and the best of friends. And while Annie and Giselda start verbally tag-teaming, the camera pans over to me, cheering on Chandel as she fires down the track.
"Look at her," comes Annie's voice. "She's amazing. Like, I would be brave enough to be out here on that ugly pipe? No way. Like, any of this was her fault. Nuh-uh."
"Cairo says we should always find ways to help others, so that's what we're doing. Big time."
Marla's voice is back now, talking over muted footage of me being interviewed on the infield.
"Jessica also seems to have adopted some wisdom from Coach Kairokowski about the whole matter."
Suddenly, my voice cuts in.
"He tells us that life isn't about what happens to you, it's about what you do about what happens to you."
Then I'm out again, and Marla's voiceover returns.
"And although she's trying hard to do something about her situation, running again will not be an option if she doesn't get a prosthesis designed specifically for running."
"I tried running on this leg the other day," I'm saying as the camera zeroes in on my pipe leg. "It was awful, just really clunky." All of a sudden, the outdoor shots are done, and they're back in the studio. Keith Frank says,
"If you want to help Jessica run again, you can."
A graphic with contact information appears on the screen as he continues.
"There's a fund set up for her, and it's obviously a good cause. Donation information is also available on our website, where we make it easy for you to make a difference."
The contact graphic disappears, and Keith says to Marla,
"That is some story."
Marla nods.
"And there's so much more to it. Jessica's family is drowning in medical bills because she wasn't insured, and the insurance companies are in gridlock over who should foot the bill. The Carlisles have had to take out a second mortgage on their house. Her father's working 14 hours a day, and this is just for her basic needs. It's a nightmare."